Dr. Daniel Pipes is the founder of the Middle East Forum, a right-wing group that campaigns against the dangers of what it sees as militant Islam. Dr. Pipes was in New Zealand recently. He's from the United States of America, which is when I spoke to him after the military cracked down on the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but before reports on the use of chemical weapons against civilians in Syria hit the news. So, given Daniel Pipes regards it as a major global threat, I began by asking Daniel for his definition of militant Islam.
Militant Islam, or radical Islam, political Islam, totalitarian Islam, Islamism, many different words, fundamentalist Islam, refers to an understanding of Islam that is arguing that Muslims will be as strong and successful today as they were a millennium ago if they adhere to Islamic law, if they do everything in accord with Islam. And so it imposes Islam on those who don't want to live by it and argues that this is the way to success.
What does that mean for a country like Saudi Arabia? Is there a distinguishing point between conservative Islam, fundamentalist Islam, and political Islam as we see in countries like Iran?
There are different forms of Islamism, which is the term I now prefer, and the Saudi and Iranian examples make that obvious. To give one specific, in Saudi Arabia, it's deemed too dangerous for women to have the right to drive. In Iran, it's deemed perfectly all right because there's an Islamic order, so it's fine for women to drive. So they have different answers, different interpretations of similar issues. But in the end, both of them are going along the same lines in that both seek in Islam answers to questions like, may women drive or not, or anything else, make war, how to raise children.
Does that mean that the West has to change the way it deals with countries like Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is currently regarded as an ally of the West, certainly regarded much differently to a country like Iran?
I think it would be a mistake to see Saudi Arabia as an ally. It is, at best, a tactical ally with which one does certain things. But the Saudi vision of how life should be conducted and ours in the West could not be more different. Indeed, it's even more different than in Iran. But politically, they're happy to work with us and we work with them. But we're not allies. We find it useful to work together. But our goals are different. Allies should have, you know, New Zealand and Australia are allies. They basically see things the same way. We Westerners and the Saudis do not see things the same way.
What does that mean in terms of the future of the Middle East? Why is militant Islam a threat? It might seem like a dumb question.
It's a threat because the Islamists aspire to global hegemony, aspire to use governments to impose their vision of Islam, are ready to use the most brutal methods, and see Western ways as the main impediment. So they're on the attack in general. Now, granted, in cases like Saudi Arabia, they're willing to work with us in the short term, but ultimately they see us as illegitimate, and they should be dominant. We should be submissive. We should accept Islam. We should accept their way of living.
Is that because they, the people you fear, want to dominate the world, or because we in the West have got caught up in great Middle Eastern conflicts, such as the conflict between Israel and its Arab neighbors, and some Arab people want to punish us for supporting Israel?
Were the Arab-Israeli conflict resolved today, very little else would change.
Why?
It's not that important. If you look, for example, these days at the neighbors of Israel, Egypt and Syria, they're consumed with their own affairs. The Palestinian-Israeli issue is of minor importance to them. And if you go further away, to Iraq, to Afghanistan, to Bangladesh, to Indonesia, this is an extremely remote issue.
Why has militant Islam grown in strength then? Has it grown in strength, actually, before?
It has very much grown in strength, yes. And I suspect it may be peaking about now. It has grown in strength because it answers the question that Muslims have, what went wrong and how do we fix it? What went wrong is that we Muslims, who used to be doing very well, are not doing well. And the way to fix it is by adhering to the Islamic law and fulfilling God's wishes, and then we Muslims will be strong and rich again.
What's your response to what's happened in Egypt in the last few days, the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi and his Egyptian Brotherhood government?
Extraordinary developments. Arguably, the June 30th demonstration against Mohamed Morsi was by far the largest political demonstration ever anywhere. Estimates go up as high as 30 million people out of a population of 80 million. It's huge. And now what we're seeing is an animosity towards the Muslim Brotherhood, ferocious, talking about it as a kind of cancer, talking about banning it, readiness to kill its adherents that I certainly did not expect. And I'm having troubles coming to terms with understanding. And in return, I should add, the Muslim Brotherhood members are furious and ready to use violence, are burning churches and destroying police stations and executing soldiers. So there was clearly a level of tension before the June 30th demonstrations that was not visible and now has become manifest.
And that military solution that we've seen, that military crackdown, I worry, just as somebody from a distance, selfishly worry that what the military are now doing in Egypt is radicalizing a bunch of young Islamic Egyptians who will now say, well, let's join the radical cause.
That could well be the case. I am less worried than you are, because when I look at the Islamist movement, I see it has two wings. One is violent, and one is not. And I would argue that the nonviolent wing is more dangerous, ultimately, than the violent wing. Yeah, the violent wing kills people in the short term, bombs, blows people up, kills them. But generally speaking, the violent wing has fewer successes than the nonviolent effort. And it's the nonviolent effort, Mohamed Morsi in Egypt, that, had he not been overthrown, would probably have led to a dictatorship that would have caused trouble both within Egypt and beyond, and killed many more people than are now under assault. So it may be counterintuitive, but I'm worrying more about the lawful Islamists than the violent Islamists.
And lawful Islamists are working not just in Egypt, but where else? Is this, when you talk about nonviolent Islamic fundamentalism, what do you mean by that in terms of other countries around the world?
Well, I think a perfect illustration would be the government of Turkey since 2002. Far more clever and restrained than Morsi in Egypt, but nonetheless implementing bit by bit Sharia, Islamic law, and moving the country in a rogue direction. Just yesterday, the Prime Minister Erdogan declared that the overthrow of Morsi was an Israeli plot. Not a happy development, this kind of thinking. So here you have Erdogan, who back in May visited the Oval Office in the White House as an honored guest of the U.S. president. And in contrast, bin Laden, 2.5 years ago, was executed by American soldiers. I think that contrast is an important one, that Erdogan is more dangerous than bin Laden.
Is Saudi Arabia more dangerous than bin Laden?
Oh, no question. Saudi Arabia is a very major power when it comes to the economy and has used its money to spread a vicious form of Islam around the world.
How does the United States respond? Is it responding well at the moment to the threats that you perceive?
No, I don't think so. My policy recommendation for the United States government, and for that matter, all Western governments, would be first never to help and always to obstruct the Islamists, who are a barbaric enemy. Secondly, always to help the moderate Muslims, the anti-Islamist Muslims, the secular, liberal, modern Muslims who once saw in Tahrir Square a couple of years ago and who do exist, just not in the corridors of power. Always help them. And thirdly, when it comes to the tyrants, be they dynastic or military or other, work with them, but work with them cautiously. Don't become too close to them. And always push them in the direction of democracy. And by democracy, I don't mean voting. I mean the whole series of civic virtues such as minority rights and rule of law and freedom of speech and elections, but move them in that direction bit by bit, always pressuring them to open up to civil society.
How does that work in, say, a country like Saudi Arabia, which is so important in terms of its energy resources? What does the states do with Saudi Arabia?
Well, the states and allies. We put pressure on them to open up, to treat the foreign workers better, to give more rights to women, to have less despotism, to have something on the order of a constitution, to have to open up. Saudi Arabia is an extremely close country in terms of a dynasty dominating the politics of the country. Well, no, that's not something we should implicitly approve of, as in fact we have done for decades.
Nights on Radio New Zealand National, speaking to Dr. Daniel Pipes from the Middle East Forum. Dr. Pipes, in the case of Iran, what's the wisest approach for the US and its allies in that country situation?
By way of background, the Iranian government has been in office now for almost 35 years and has implemented a form of Islamism that is highly unpopular. A very substantial majority of Iranians don't like the ideology they're being fed, don't like the order that they live in. So I think the system is weak and is ripe for overthrow. That's one point. Second point is that the Iranian government has devoted itself to building nuclear weapons, and in part maybe doing so not just for the usual strategic reasons, but because of ideas floating around the leadership circles that anarchy, chaos, are what will bring on the end of days, the Mahdi, the day of resurrection, and that nuclear weapons are a great way to create anarchy. So I worry hugely that the government is not just building, but will deploy nuclear weapons. And therefore, I'm of the opinion that although striking at the Iranian nuclear installations would lead to painful consequences, those are almost trivial in comparison with the consequences of the Iranians having nuclear weapons, the Iranian leadership having nuclear weapons at its disposal.
But do you think that you also run the risk of once again radicalizing a whole lot of Islamists around the world, or just people who believe in Allah, if you attack Iran? And with Iran just voting for a more moderate candidate in its recent presidential elections, is there not room for dialogue with that country? If we can deal with Saudi Arabia, can't we deal with Iran in a peaceful way?
2 points. First, we don't know what the Iranian response, you said around the world, but let's limit ourselves to Iran. We don't know what the Iranian response to an attack would be. It could be that they would say, as you're suggesting, that the outsiders, the Americans, the Israelis, or whoever, have attacked us and we must support our leadership. But it could also be the reverse, that our foolish leadership in this mad dash for nuclear electricity, which is what they claim it's for, has exposed us to all these dangers and made us pay all these prices. What a crazy group. We must get rid of them. I acknowledge it, that Iranians believe they have the right to develop nuclear energy. But how far are you going to go with that? What if there is a real price to be paid? What if there is an attack on Iran because of it? I don't know what the results are. I just don't know.
Does Israel not have atomic weapons?
I believe it does, yes. I don't think there's any comparison, do you?
If Israel hasn't used atomic weapons either. And it's surrounded by very aggressive neighbors.
It is indeed.
Some neighbors who want to destroy Israel.
It is indeed. And there are other states as well that have nuclear weapons, and some of which have had very vicious rulers when they had nuclear weapons. Stalin, Mao, Kim Jong-il. But none of them, and I'm certainly not happy that they have nuclear weapons, but none of them had the apocalyptic mindset that one finds in the Iranian leadership, which makes it even more dangerous.
What's your feeling about the current way the United States is waging its so-called war on terror? Has it won that war?
Well, I've never liked the term war on terror because it suggests there's a war on a tactic. It would be after Pearl Harbor that the United States engaged in a war on surprise attacks. You know, it wasn't really the issue. It was an ideology, the fascist ideology that we were fighting. And today it's the Islamist ideology that we're fighting. If I might rephrase your question, how is the war on the Islamist ideology going? Not very well. We've not been very effective. But the Islamists themselves are fighting each other. In the prominent countries of the Middle East, one finds over and over again that people who had been allies in the Islamist movement are now finding it more and more difficult to get along. In a place like Syria, there's actually a civil war. But in other countries as well, there are tensions that are rising. So no credit to the United States. But as they have become more powerful, these movements have divided.
How do you feel about the closure of U.S. embassies recently?
I was appalled.
Why?
In the first place, I don't think. I mean, we have this enormous army, these great intelligence services, and two guys talk to each other, and we close down 21 embassies and then 19 for a week. What is all this for? I mean, do we have, must we preemptively cringe when there's some perceived threat? And then secondly, I would imagine that these two guys talking were well aware that the NSA and other American services were listening to them. So they're yapping away about doing this and that, and bingo, they closed down all these missions abroad.
Are you sad U.S. embassies these days are often fortresses?
Yeah, I find that very disturbing. They're on hills, they've got moats and walls, and try and open a door in an American embassy. You really need to be strong. It's not the way we should be doing business. I believe in deterrence. I believe we should be indicating to those who would attack us that they will pay a very severe price. Don't you dare do it, rather than barricading ourselves behind these walls and moats.
A severe price to individuals who attack, or to nations who harbor them, or both?
Organizations, all of it. Anybody who attacks us will pay a price.
We have seen Osama bin Laden killed. We've seen many leaders of Al-Qaeda attacked and killed. Is the U.S. not doing this enough? Should it be doing more of that?
Well, Al-Qaeda is a tiny proportion of the Islamist movement. And unfortunately, the U.S. government has focused on Al-Qaeda leadership and crosses off names as they're disposed of, as though that were the key. But as I argued to you a few minutes ago, I see the nonviolent Islamists as more dangerous than the violent ones. So I'm not terribly impressed.
Now, how do we deal with the nonviolent ones? Violently?
No. I think there should be two main steps. One is to reject them. Reject them from the media, reject them from the academy, reject them from the law courts, reject them from the political process. These are not legitimate actors, in the same way that, say, Nazis would not be legitimate actors. They should not be given a place at the table. And secondly, we should help Muslims who are trying to develop an alternative understanding of what it means to be a Muslim, which is modern, good neighborly, moderate.
Who decides who's a radical Islamist and who is not? We have conservative fundamentalist Christians and Jews. Are they not part of, should they not be part of any debate as well?
No, they should not. I resist any comparison with Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, or other religions. I think the proper comparison, as I've suggested a couple of times, is with fascism and communism. This is a radical utopian ideology that seeks worldwide hegemony and is using brutal means to achieve it.
Can other religions not be fascist as well?
They could be, perhaps, but they're not. There's no other religion.
And never have been?
Never. Well, no, there's nothing like this ideological movement that we now see in Islam. So, it's not the whole of Islam, but it is a portion of Islam.
What you seem to be saying is that only Islam can be fascist in this way. Other major religions can't be.
Well, I'd prefer not to use the word fascist, but let's use the word totalitarian. Or let's use the word global hegemony. I suppose another religion could be, but in fact they're not. So let's not talk about theory, let's talk about practice. Islamism, like fascism and communism, presents a danger to the world. No religion, as such, presents such a danger.
But I don't understand why that religion alone has this potential, or has done so in practice.
It is the most political of religions.
If this has a tendency, should we not tolerate this religion at all then?
If it has such
dangerous tendencies?
I have no problem with the religion as such. I have a problem with its political expression, especially when it has an Islamist tone.
Is Zionism not a political expression of a religion as well?
No, it's a Jewish national movement. Indeed, the founders of Zionism were themselves secular We're looking at the problems that Jews had, for example, in Austria and France, and said Jews need to have a state of their own. It's not about religion.
Is there any moderate Islamic state that you point to and say, yes, this is the beacon?
There were a couple in the Middle East that are now gone. If pressed, I would say probably Indonesia would be the best bet. I would have said a few years ago Tunisia and Turkey. But the moderates are under severe pressure from the Islamists at this point.
Why does the Palestinian question have no bearing on this, when it's been a rallying point for so many Muslims in the Middle East?
In the first place, many Muslims are fed up with it. It's not going anywhere. There's no possibility of success, which by success I mean eliminating Israel.
But if we supported Fatah in its attempts to win over people in Gaza, would that not be a victory for moderate Islam?
I don't see... No, I don't think so. Fatah is not an Islamic organization. It's a nationalist organization. It's about politics. And it seeks no less than Hamas to eliminate Israel. I call them the good terrorists and the bad terrorists. They use different tactics.
That's not what they're saying anymore.
Oh, my. You should look at the sermons and the school books and the newspapers full of celebration of martyrs. The Israelis just released 26 murderers, and they're seen as national heroes. No, the message is clear and loud. Israel, the Jewish state, cannot be allowed to exist. They're willing to work with it, make deals with it, but their goal is obvious. I have no faith in Fatah or Hamas. I think they are both irredentist movements that seek to destroy.
Should there be a Palestinian state one day if Palestinians can acknowledge the legitimacy of an Israeli state?
When the happy day comes that Palestinians are in substantial numbers, 60, 70, 80%, accepting the Jewish state of Israel, I have no problem with the Palestinian state.
Is Israel
state.
Doing all
but
it that, can?
But that, excuse me, that is very far away. In the meantime, I believe it's more practical to have Jordan back in the West Bank and Egypt back in Gaza.
Is the Israeli regime doing all it can
far
to persuade Palestinians to support its legitimacy?
The things the Israelis do, they appall me by the things they do, such as these 104 murderers that are being released. All of them are murderers. Can you imagine any other country releasing murderers? It's quite interesting because the Mexicans released recently, after 28 years, some drug dealer who'd killed an American. And the U.S. government was up in arms over this. He shouldn't be released. And yet the same U.S. government is pressing the Israelis to release 104 murderers. The states don't do this. They don't release murderers like this. And I don't think the Israelis should, but they are doing it. And anyone who questions their bona fides, just look at that. And it's not just this instance. They have, for example, in 2005, again, I was against it, but they pulled out 9,000 of their residents from Gaza, uprooted them, and handed over their houses to the Palestinians. The Israelis make too many efforts, in my view, to appease and win over Palestinian sentiment. I don't think it's going to work. I'm not against it in principle. I just don't think it's going to work. But the Israelis sure are trying.
Daniel, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Forum.